When I was 10, I noticed my dad one day walking out in the woods behind our property, and I was at the age that, you know, I read about cowboys and Indians and all that type of thing, and I thought, boy, it'd be fun to be a scout or a guide or a trapper or something like that. So I thought, I'm going to follow him and see where he goes. Now, I don't know if he knew I was following him or not, but in any event, he took off through the woods, and I and my trusty dog, Mickey, were right behind him, not where he could see us. But in any event, he went through our woods, crossed the road, and then went to a woods behind us. And as he got into this new growth, I lost sight of him. And I kept going in the direction I thought he was going, thinking that, well, maybe I'll catch up with him. But at some point, I finally realized, well, I'm lost. I don't have a clue where I am, and there's probably a very slim chance of, you know, catching up with him. So I wasn't too concerned because we lived on a main road. It was actually Old Highway 2. If you ever go between Salton and Monroe, it's pretty much straight along the flat. But years and years ago, the old highway was up on the hill, and we lived on that road. So I thought, well, all I have to do is just listen for the road noise, because it was heavily traveled and there was a lot of noise, so I could orient myself. And I thought, well, I'll just go back toward the road and, you know, I can walk home from there. So I listened to the road noise and I started off going back, but I was going kind of in a bleak fashion, not going back the way I had come, because I didn't recognize any of the area. Pretty soon I could hear the road noise getting closer, so I knew I was getting closer to the road, and finally I could hear people talking in a house that was a short distance away. Unfortunately, I ran into this huge clump of blackberries. And of course, blackberries are indigenous to this area, just like moles and rain and cloudy weather, like today. I mean, they're all over. They're on the perimeter of everyone's garden or the perimeter of everyone's lawn, and they just grow. And if you've ever had to cut into a big bunch of them, you'll find old, dried up vines from years before. They just accumulate. And somehow I had gotten into them. And I think what I did, in thinking about it, I think I tried to walk on some of the vines to tramp them down, thinking I could do that and get through that big clump of vines. But instead, what happened, I did that, and then I went a little further, and they sprung back. And I not only couldn't go forward, I couldn't go sideways, and I couldn't go back, so I was trapped. And in the process of doing everything that I'd done and getting as far as I did, I obviously got stabbed by thorns and everything, so I wasn't in a mood to do much of that. So I thought, well, there's a house pretty close, I'll just yell and try and attract someone's attention. So I yelled, "Help! Help! Help!" And I could hear someone talking. And finally, I heard an elderly woman say, "Are you all right? Who are you? What's going on?" And I recognized her voice. Her name was Mrs. Garrity. She was from North Carolina, and she was elderly. She was, I think, was in her 80s. And I said, "I'm John Petrosor. I'm stuck in all these blackberries, and I need someone to get me out. Would you go down and tell my parents where I am?" She said, "All right, just wait a minute." And so I, you know, sat there, and seemed like an eternity. I finally heard Mom yelling. She said, "John, are you okay?" And I said, "Yes." And I could hear the snip, snip, snip of the clippers as they started working. And I think she'd gotten a couple of neighbors, recruited them on the way back. And so it took maybe 10 or 15 minutes to cut me out of there. At the time when she reached me, as parents often are, she was she varied between emotions. She was just relieved I was all right, and then she got mad at me for getting in that position, you know. First she was glad, and then she got mad, and then I think she got mad at Dad because she thought that I was with him. So she started blaming him, not knowing that Dad didn't have a clue where I was. So in any event, she finally got home. But it's when she got home, when we got home, she said the thing that was very, very upsetting to her was that Mrs. Garrity came and knocked on the door and said, "You better come quickly. Your boy's done hung up." And Mom just heard the words "hung," and she didn't hear anything else. She went out the door, went out for the clippers, and I think her reaction was a little bit related to something that I told my parents that I wanted to do. We had these huge old growth stumps on our property. There was one, a big cedar stump that was wide enough to drive a car through, and it was about 15 or 20 feet high. And any of you that have ever driven up on the highway, I think it's around Arlington, they used to have a stump on the road there that you could drive through. I don't know if it's still there, but it was that big. But anyway, I told them, I want to take ropes and build a treehouse on one of these stumps and then take the rope from the stump to some of the big pine trees and other cedar trees and make a regular network and go to other stumps and then go over them hand by hand so that I can move in and around the forest kind of like Tarzan. And so she probably heard, when she heard "hung up," she was thinking, "Oh, is he there hanging from a tree? You know, is he strangled?" Anyway, I don't think she ever forgave Mrs. Garrity about that. I mean, because of what she said. Have you ever been hung up or known anyone who has? And I'm not speaking literally, of course, but do you know someone now who is hung up? You hear people talking about, they're really hung up on this, or they're hung up on that. I used to have a device that was called a hang-up. It was a slant board that was on a pivot, on a frame, and you could get on it, and there was a place to fasten your feet to, and then you could back, had a way of flipping it so it would go back. Presumably it was good for your back. Natasha, our granddaughter, one time when we were at the feast, I think it was in Kelowna, she was in her late teens, she sat down next to me before one of the services and said, "Grandpa, I love you. I'm so glad that Desiree and I can hang with you, with the parents." And of course that amused me, because when she said "hang," I envisioned this big cave of bats hanging from the ceiling, twittering and tweeting to each other. But that was the jargon, you know. We used to say, "Well, let's hang out together," but now they've reduced it to "hang." It's kind of like they use a lot of abbreviations. I never did know what LOL meant until someone explained that meant laugh out loud, you know, ha ha, at the end of someone's email. Well, what does it mean to be hung up? Usually, the way we think of it, when you're hung up about something, it usually means that you're prevented from doing a task, or you're blocked from doing a task. Maybe the road's blocked and you're hung up in traffic. At work, you may be hung up because of a complex problem that you're working on that you can't find a resolution to. Or if you're a writer, sometimes people, you hear them talk about writer's block. They reach a certain impasse, a certain point where they're just simply stalled. They can't go forward. They don't know how to develop the story. Should they go down this path or should they go down this path? Because depending on which way they go, that means the story takes a completely different tack. You may have borrowed $5,000 from the bank to remodel your home. And it suddenly dawns on you, and you suddenly realize that in 4 weeks, or I should say in 2 months, it's the night to be remembered. And you've invited 20 people over. The only problem is now you've got an unfinished house and you don't anticipate being able to finish because you ran out of money. So being hung up can be as inconsequential of as trying to solve a problem for, you know, if you have homework in school, trying to solve a math problem or something like that. However, if you are sitting on death row, you may really be hung up on the gallows if your attorney is unable to get a stay of execution. You hear people talk about saying, I finally hung it up and retired last year. Or sometimes when you're going down the road and you get lost, and someone will, you know, ask for directions, and they may say something like, well, just stay on this road and hang a right at the third stoplight. Or if you're in Jamaica, hang loose, man. You know, hang loose, take it easy. Don't sweat it. And finally, we say to people who have maybe been through a severe trial and have shown a great deal of perseverance, we say, well, just hang in there. So there are a lot of connotations attached to that word. Turn to 2 Samuel 17. 2 Samuel 17, I'm going to be reading from the NIV, and I'm not going to read the story. I'm just going to relate it for the sake of time. But anyway, that's the example where David has fled the country because he knew that Absalom was after him, was trying to kill him. And Absalom asked David's former advisor, Ahithophel, what he should do. Now, if you read the last verse in chapter 16, it talks about the status Ahithophel held. He was revered and respected by everyone. It was like he was a conduit to God. Not only King David valued his advice, but Absalom did as well. But he had opted to stay with Absalom when David left. In any event, Absalom asked him, well, what should I do? Should we go after David now? And he said, yes, by all means. You'll have the element of surprise going for you, and he's not going to expect you to come quite as quickly. So take a troop of soldiers and go after him right now. That was Ahithophel's advice. But another advisor, Hushi, also was asked by Absalom. He wanted to just get a confirmation that that was good advice, and the other man said, no, you shouldn't do that at all. If you corner David now, he's a fierce fighter, and his soldiers, the people with him, are handpicked, and they are going to fight to the death because of their loyalty to him. And you probably won't have a chance. So what you need to do is you need to go out throughout Israel and gather a large army, and then you won't have any problem at all in subduing him because you'll have numbers on your side. And in verse 23, when Ahithophel saw that his advice had not been followed, he saddled his donkey and set out for his house in his hometown. If you think about what had happened to him, here he was a trusted advisor to the king. He was, in a way, a right-hand person to the king. And hopefully, by staying with his son, he hoped to have that same position. But because of what happened, it was as though his credibility was entirely on the line. His value as an advisor was at stake the way he saw it. And I think, although this is kind of reading between the lines, that because of his position, he may just have been a little arrogant, and he may just have had a little bit of an ego problem with that whole thing. Because why would one suggestion that was not followed destroy a man's entire career? It just didn't make sense unless there was something else. Now, we know that God intended it to work out the way it did. It says that clearly. He wanted Hushai to give, Ahithophel to give the wrong advice so that it would end up with Absalom dying. However, he got to his hometown. He probably, all the way back on his donkey, had his head hung over. He put his house in order, and then he hanged himself. So he died and was buried in his father's tomb. Well, how many of you have been hung up in that you may have been offended in the past by something that someone has said to you or someone has done, and it may have been something that happened right here in this church? And you might say, occur here? You can't possibly mean the United Church of God. Absolutely. If you do not think that can happen here, then stick around for a while, because even as remarkable as our congregation is, it does occur. It does happen. People get hung up by something that someone does, someone says. That's just the way it is, being that we're all subject to human nature. In Matthew 18, verse 7, and I'm going to be quoting the NIV again, Matthew 18, verse 7, Jesus is saying, "Woe to the world because of the things that cause people to stumble." He's giving a warning. He's talking about the things that can happen. And he uses the word world here. I like to refer to, and you don't have to turn to it because I don't want to read the whole thing. I'm just going to paraphrase it. But you all are familiar with the parable of the wheat and the tares, where the enemy comes in, plants bad seed along with the good seed, and later on the servants of the owner of this plot of land come and tell him what's happened. And ask him, what should we do? Should we just plow the whole field up now and forget it? And he said, no, if we do that, what's going to happen is we're going to not have any crop at all. But he said, just let them grow side by side. Let everything grow. And when it gets to maturity, we'll be able to distinguish between them. And if you've heard this before, you may be aware that a wheat kernel, when it is at maturity and it is filled with all of the wheat kernels, it'll bend over because of the weight. It's like bowing. Whereas the tares, very small seeds, very fine, didn't weigh a lot at all, so the kernel of the tare would remain upright. So at that point in time, when it had matured, it was very easy to pull, you know, the tare and burn it, and pull the good stalk of wheat and harvest it. In any event, continuing in Matthew 18:7. Oh, and the reason that I mention that is that if a tare, or if a Christian, or someone who within a group acts like a Christian, talks like a Christian, reads out of the Bible, does things that you expect a Christian to do, but inwardly they're totally different. And of course God knows the difference, but a lot of times we as humans don't recognize that difference. In any event, a tear would be, as far as Christ would be concerned, would be part of the world. He might be in the congregation. You might think he's a Christian, but he's just as well a part of the world. Such things must come, the things that cause people to stumble, but woe to the person through whom they come. And I might ask, if something happens to you within the congregation, I'm not suggesting you ascribe it immediately to someone being a tear. But the question I have is, how are you responding when things like that happen? What is your response? When you're hung up on something, sometimes people feel like they're being ignored, or maybe they are, either intentionally or unintentionally. I know sometimes, particularly on the week we have Family Fellowship Club, there's a lot of things going on to try to get done before we meet. And I may be running around, and I sometimes feel bad about it because I'd like to stop and talk, and yet I can't. I just, on my way. And it's not intentional on my part, and I'm sure there are others that are involved in different things, and the same thing happens. Sometimes, though, people are offended. They feel slighted. They feel like maybe they did something wrong, and that's why, no one's paying attention to them. But that's not the case at all. But people that are really hung up in this way can let it lead to a lack of trust. They can be frustrated. They can be angry. And it can lead to broken relationships as well. Some people get hung up if the minister makes a mistake or gives them certain advice which is offensive to them for whatever reason. Maybe they even leave because of it. In a situation like that, maybe not all of the facts were given to the minister. Maybe only part of the facts were given to him, and based on what he was told, he decided on a specific course of action and suggested it based on what he, knew. If the facts are slanted, either intentionally or accidentally, or some salient or important bit of information is left out, again, maybe accidentally or unintentionally, it's easy for someone to give questionable advice based on wrong information. In the early years of the church, there was a culture extant where it seems like you wouldn't do anything at all unless you consulted with the minister. And that was, purchase of household items. If you were buying a car, you expected pretty much to be able to talk to him about it, and he might advise you even on the model or the accessories or, things like that. And unless the person had actually owned the car and had intimate knowledge about it, or was a mechanic and had worked on it, or had some special information in that regard, really the only kind of advice he could have given would have been something like, is it within your budget? Can you afford it? If it's a used car, have you had a mechanic look at it? But, as I said, there was a culture about decisions, and you didn't sneeze without finding out if it was all right. Now, I'm being a little facetious there. I think, however, that maybe we've reached a point where the pendulum has perhaps swung to the other end of the spectrum. People, I think, are more reluctant now to open up and to let the minister know their real inner self. I think of like two dogs, and you've probably all seen this. You've seen two dogs square off. And they're getting ready to fight, and maybe they even begin fighting, and then one of them suddenly will lie down on his back and expose his belly. showing his sign of being submissive and open, because he's probably figured out as the fight started, or maybe even before, that this guy's the dominant alpha dog, and there's nothing I'm going to be able to do, and the only thing I'm going to end up with is a really sore belly if he tears into it, and if he gets really mad, he might get to some of my vital organs and inflict serious damage. But are we willing to open up like that and let the minister know what's going on in our lives? You know, there are many people that have left that probably, in all likelihood, if they had been willing to do that, would still be here, because the things that happened and the things that were going on in their life could have been corrected. But they weren't, because no one knew. Are we hung up so it prevents us from doing the same thing? Will the minister think less of us? Every elder has human nature. They have the same pulls we do. We can prove it by going to 1 Corinthians 9, verse 27. And once again, I'm reading from the NLT. 1 Corinthians 9:27, where Paul says, "I discipline my body like an athlete, training it to do what it should." You know, Lenny Wilkins, back in 1979, led the Supersonics to a championship. And we know what happened with the Seattle Seahawks just a couple of weeks ago. And what's going on in Sochi now, if you... you know, watch the athletes in action on TV, and you look at the things that they do. If you look at the people on the football field and see the bruising punishment that they take in order to be able to endure that and to be able to stand it and not end up flat on their back, they have to be trained, and they have to be honed to the point where that is something they can endure. Paul is saying, "Otherwise, I fear that after preaching to others, if I'm not doing the same thing, if I'm not disciplining my body in the same way that an athlete does, that after standing up in front of all of you, and for years, perhaps, in his case, preaching to them and telling them what they should do, he says, I fear that after doing this to others, I myself might be disqualified." So do we discipline our bodies like an Olympic athlete? Do we approach our calling as Christians the same way? What are you hung up on that prevents you from attaining peak performance? Paul compared himself, as I said before, to an athlete, and he used that analogy to demonstrate that we need the same focus, we need the same intensity, we need the same dedication. We can't take our calling lightly or be cavalier or just casual about the way we approach that calling. If we do, we may not be surrounded by an impenetrable forest of blackberry bushes as viewed by a 10-year-old boy, but we're hung up by something that restricts us and keeps us bound in much the same way. We may not be on death row, but we need to consider that what we're hung up on could lead us there, and I'm speaking spiritually speaking, and ultimately on death row. We always need to be alert to the areas of our lives where we can get hung up on. You know, I think we pretty well understand our weaknesses. If I was to ask anyone, and you were really being candid, and we don't like to reveal them, so I'm sure no one would, but I'm sure you could all tell me what's going to keep you out of the kingdom of God. one or two things. You all know it. You all know what it is. I don't have to tell you because it just instantaneously is in your mind. Yeah, that's right. If I do that, I know where I'm going to end up. Anyway, they're not a mystery to us. But how do we treat them? Do we cuddle up with them? Do we hold them close to us like an object covered with gold, like some collector's item? And I'm speaking figuratively here, but I hope you get the point. What is it that you're hung up on? I don't think there's any teenagers here today, at least I didn't notice any, but is it some boy or some girl that you're focused on as an adult? Is it some man or some woman? Or is it a job or is it a position, either in or out of the church, that you have in your gun sight? Turn to 2 Corinthians 10, verse 12. 2 Corinthians 10, verse 12. Quoting from the NLT, Paul was taken to task here by some of the Corinthians who said, you know, Paul, he's no big deal. You know, he writes these real forceful letters to us, really, you know, tearing us apart and calling a spade. But when you see him, you know, he's kind of this puny person and he doesn't know how to speak very well, but we're pretty important. And they were talking about, you know, how important they were. And Paul says, oh, don't worry. We wouldn't dare say that we're as wonderful as these other men, of course, being facetious, who tell you how important they are. But they are only comparing themselves with each other, using themselves as a standard of measurement. And his comment on that was how ignorant, how stupid that is when you compare yourself with someone else, be it in this room or somewhere out in the workplace or somewhere in the neighborhood or wherever it might be. What an idiotic thing to do, because if that's what you're doing, you're going to be hung up on that for the rest of your life. Because regardless of how brilliant you are, be it professionally, in business or academia, you know what? There's always, always going to be someone out there who's just a little bit smarter or faster or better. So if you use people as your yardstick, even if you measure up, you're never going to be satisfied. Use the tried and true template that will pass the test of time. The example of Jesus. The New Testament, as Rod mentioned, you'll find, it's absolutely replete with things that he said, things that he did, the way he did them. I mean, if you want a template, if you want to compare yourself with someone, there's your template. If you try to attain equality with that regard, you're going to have a full-time job. But use that as a template. Don't use someone in this room. Don't use someone at work. Don't use someone maybe in your family or the neighbor or whatever. Use the example that has stood the test of time. Let the people around you play the measurement game if that's what's happening. Let them toss sleeplessly at night, trying to figure out how to play the game of one-upsmanship on someone else. You know, I think you already know the end result of that type of thinking. You keep focused on the only yardstick in your life that will provide you happiness today as well as the future. As Rod mentioned, the Passover's in 2 months, but it's not too early to begin examining yourself and your life, as we're told to do in 1 Corinthians 11:28. And we're not going to turn there, but I'm just saying now is a good a time as any to begin that process of self-examination. You may never be hung up in a clump of blackberry bushes, and I hope you never are, but that may be small potatoes compared to perhaps what you're hung up on right now. In spite of what today, in this time and in this place, causes you to be hung up, no, in no way negates the hope you can have, because Jesus himself hung up on a hard, unyielding stake so that all of you and all of your hang-ups could and would be removed forever.